On September 28, 2016, in Townville, South Carolina, 14-year-old Jesse Osborne shot and killed his father. He then drove to Townville Elementary School, where he killed 6-year-old Jacob Hall and wounded 2 other victims. Earlier this month, Osborne, who's now 17, was sentenced as a juvenile to life without parole. The United States is the only country in the world that sentences juveniles to life in prison. The United Nations, human rights groups, and many legal organizations, including the American Bar Association, have all called for an end to life without parole for children. According to the ACLU, there are approximately 2,570 inmates in the country who are currently serving life without parole sentences that they received as juveniles. According to the Washington Post, in the past 2 years, there have been 8 shootings at K-12 schools where an underage gunman killed someone, which means that more sentences like Osborne's could soon be handed down. Joining me now to talk about juvenile life without parole sentences is Marcia Levick, Chief Legal Officer and co-founder of the Juvenile Law Center. Thanks for being with us, Marcia.
Thank you.
It's a very complicated and thorny issue to unpack. Let's talk about who is receiving these sentences. What's the demographic breakdown of juveniles? Who are they?
The best data that we have suggests that probably about 40% of them are men and women of color, mostly African American. While they're not a majority of the individuals who have received that sentence, they are disproportionately represented, which is what we see across our justice system.
Given that, and given the fact that we also know that there are biases, sentencing biases that show up in courtrooms when it comes to defendants of color, is this conversation emerging now because many of the school shooters that we're seeing are white and male?
First, I want to say that issues about racism in the justice system aren't limited to sentencing. And I really think it's important for your listeners to appreciate that it starts at the beginning. So we do need to look at what happens at the arrest stage, what happens at charging, and ultimately what happens at sentencing. I think that the concern about school shootings is also a complicated issue because, as with each new school shooting, I think it raises not only questions about our justice system and how we respond to them, but obviously, of course, gun control. So it becomes a more complicated question, but it certainly has been a piece of the motivation, I think, for the very robust conversation we're having about our justice system right now.
Part of that conversation also involves criminal justice reform, which we know was essentially scuttled in the 1990s because of the Bill Clinton crime bill. Many of the programs that went into attempting to rehabilitate and correct offenders' behavior were disbanded in favor of more punitive measures. Is that part of the reason why this is emerging in the conversation now?
Absolutely, yes. And I think that we can look back now at what happened in the 1990s, the perpetuation at that time of the super predator myth, something that led to the treatment of the Central Park Five in the way that they were presumed guilty. And yes, we are not only paying the price for that in terms of the mass incarceration, but also the numbers of young people who were pushed into that system.
When we talk about the nature of a crime and how that plays into this, you mentioned that some of these were mandatory sentences, which is something else that's being discussed a lot when it comes to criminal justice reform. But are courts in general less sympathetic when it comes to school shooters? These are folks who generally, are killing their child peers in many instances. We've seen shootings from elementary school through high school. Is there a sense that if it's not a mandatory sentence, that that's part of what goes into deciding these life sentences for juvenile offenders?
I think that we do have a history in this country of elevating victims who are young people. And certainly that includes the victims of school shooters. There are many states across the country that impose higher penalties where the victim is a child, child sexual abuse, for example. So I think that's a piece of it. We're in a difficult position with many school shootings because many of the school shooters are either killed or kill themselves. So that in research terms, the sample that we have is not ideal in trying to sort out what happens in those cases. And I do think that because mandatory sentencing was just abolished by the Supreme Court just about 7 or 8 years ago and really only made applicable to all of the states in the country just a few years ago, we're still sorting out how discretionary sentence where that will lead in terms of how particular shooters with particular victims, how that will be addressed. I do want to add, though, that we certainly know from the death penalty research that has been done in terms of capital sentencing, and I suspect that some of this will play out for life without parole, for juvenile, for children as well, is that also the race of the victim matters. And so while we may not see the gross disproportionality in terms of more than half, for example, of individuals on death row being men or women of color, if the victim is white, that absolutely has been demonstrated to be a significant factor in sentencing. So that's something that we'll be looking for as well.
We're having a conversation today on our show about empathy in the criminal justice system. And I wonder where you see this headed, this issue in particular headed in the future, if whether there's any upcoming cases or laws that could really overhaul life without parole and really bring to light the question of, for example, if someone is not sentenced to life without parole, what then? Do we focus on rehabilitation, or are there some folks who are just not able to be rehabilitated?
I think we are seeing a shift, an increasing willingness to try to hold those individuals accountable, but in developmentally appropriate ways. And what I mean by that, of course, is recognizing that as teenagers and adolescents, they are different from you and me. They're not adults. We really need to continue to ask ourselves, what is the goal of our justice system? Part of it is certainly public safety, but it is also about rehabilitation. The vast majority of individuals who go into the justice system come home. And when they come home, we want them to come home in ways that they're prepared and that they're able to integrate back into their communities successfully. There will be some individuals who won't be able to do that. And I think the Supreme Court left open the possibility that there will be particular teenagers or adolescents who over time will simply never get to that point of demonstrating maturity, of showing rehabilitation. And they may not get out of prison. But I also think the court has made it clear that today in this country, it is really incumbent upon us to provide opportunities for release.
Marsha Levick is the chief legal officer and the co-founder of the Juvenile Law Center. Marsha, thanks so much.
Thank you.